Today's episode of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you in part by Get Console. Forget using ISSH or other generic iPad terminal apps. Get Console was designed and developed by CCIE specifically for network engineers to speed up their data center work. Get Console is the best Apple-approved app for iPad serial connectivity. Apart from standard Telnet and SSH, only Get Console allows you to connect your iPad to network gear using a serial console cable, meaning data center tasks that used to require lugging a laptop can now be completed quickly using an iPad or even an iPhone. In addition, with Get Console, you can combine field engineer skills with those of senior staff in the NOC. Get Console enables full remote control of the iPad's terminal window for instant collaboration and specialist assistance. With Get Console, you can turn your iPhone into an instant out-of-band modem for the Cisco TAC or other specialists to get into network gear even when the WAN is down. Get Console has many more features, including full logging, config downloads, tight cut-and-paste integration, and at only $10 is a worthy addition to your networking toolkit. Check out www.getconsole.co.uk and use discount code PACKETPUSHERS at the checkout to receive a 10% discount on an iPad serial cable.
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking industry podcast where folks who build networks for a living gather in the virtual conference room to exchange opinions, talk technology, and chat with excellent industry guests. I am Ethan Banks, network engineer, CCIE, and blogger up at packetpushers.net. You can follow me on Twitter at EC Banks and share with me on Google+. And as always with us is Mr. Greg Farrow. Greg, how's the week going, sir?
It's going well, good, better, bad. So, okay, yeah.
You know? Yeah, you set up for okay.
Back after Christmas, it's kind of up. I got depressed when I realized that we'd put out 100 shows. That's like, wow.
Yeah, it's depressing and it's awesome all at the same time. We hit the century mark. Not bad.
It is. And you know, I was thinking back on all the people, you know, that have helped us out with the show, all the hosts and the guests who've come on and taken their time to say things, which has been pretty fantastic, really.
Yeah, a lot of voices have come through, a lot of really cool people from the industry, and we keep getting emails from folks that it's surprising who's listening, it's surprising who's come on, and we think 2012 is going to be a pretty great year. And we're really starting off with kind of an interesting guest here. Greg and I, and of course several others that have been on the show, are advocates of IPv6. I mean, without a doubt, we know that's where the world is going. Of necessity, and the sooner we just grab the bull by the horns and say, all right, let's figure this thing out and let's make this go, the better the world is going to be, and none of this NAT stuff if we can help it. And to kind of help get folks in the mood of adopting IPv6, Hurricane Electric has got a service out there called Tunnel Broker, which you can take advantage of at tunnelbroker.net. And I pinged those guys via one of their mailboxes and got a response back from Mr. Owen DeLong, who said he'd be happy to come on the show and chat with us about tunnelbroker.net and what service they're really providing there. So, Owen, welcome to the show, and why don't you introduce yourself, Hurricane Electric, and tell us what you do for those folks.
Well, thank you, Ethan. I'm Owen DeLong, as you said. I'm an IPv6 evangelist, and I'm also our director of IPv6 professional services. So mostly I run around the world giving presentations about IPv6 and teaching people how to do IPv6, which is just about the coolest job I could imagine. And I'm also a member of the Aaron Advisory Council, which means I'm part of a 15-member body that helps the community develop addressing policies for the United States, Canada, and I think 21 or 23 Caribbean nations that are in our service region. And wow. Hurricane Electric is a major backbone provider, backbone ISP. We also have some colo facilities in Fremont and New York where we do some hosting, and that's pretty much what we do. And we're the leader in IPv6, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things we learned when we did a show with Aaron last year and talked quite a bit, and one of the questions that came up is there truly a global internet IPv6? And the answer he said is yes, and I know you guys are one of the players there.
Absolutely. We run a full dual-stack native backbone on three continents at this point. So.
Now, one of the ways that folks can tap into IPv6 if their ISP is not offering it, which a lot of ISPs are not, particularly residential ISPs, is they could tap into tunnelbroker.net, which you guys are offering absolutely free. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what tunnelbroker.net is doing, what it's really accomplishing, and how folks can get into it.
Sure. Well, tunnelbroker.net is a way that we give back to the community. We basically provide a free service where, as you said, people can go to the website, configure their tunnel, and we'll even help them configure their equipment. There's email support available if they get lost. There's some training on the basics of IPv6 and some help there for how to do various things with IPv6. And it's really been a great project that's allowed us to help to get literally tens of thousands of people online on IPv6 all over the world. It really works out very well for both us and for the community, I think.
Yeah, the idea being with the tunnel here, a lot of folks, all they've got at home is IPv4, or even businesses, all they've got is IPv4. I know I'm in a situation, we've got a couple of carriers that feed us internet. One of my carriers will give me IPv6 service, the other one is not ready yet. They're testing and it's coming, but it's not there yet. Well, with tunnelbroker.net, I can take my IPv4 connection that I do have, build an IPv4-based tunnel, and then put IPv6 packets inside that tunnel that will go from my location to the Hurricane Electric backbone, and Hurricane Electric will then take my IPv6 traffic, put it out on the IPv6 internet, and I'm connected. I got that pretty well right, yes?
That's exactly correct. That's exactly how it works. And in fact, you're lucky. Neither of the layer 2 providers that I'm using at my house is capable of delivering IPv6 services. So I'm having to use tunnels to Hurricane Electric and to a router I've gotten another colo to get my dual-homed ISP service for IPv6.
You had mentioned a little bit earlier that there's a lot of help on the tunnelbroker.net site to configure your equipment to connect up to IPv6, get that tunnel nailed up. And yeah, I'll confirm that. There's a lot of different help that's out there. And it doesn't, there's a lot more residential grade equipment that'll support this now. You don't have to have a Juniper or a Cisco router with a full-blown network operating system to be able to do this. I did this with a Linksys E4200 that had IPv6 tunneling capability built in, nailed up my tunnel to Hurricane Electric, and it's been working since. And that box even has an IPv6 firewall built in, so I can run stateful firewall IPv6, and it works great. So don't think, oh, my equipment probably won't do it. It might. You should look and check and see whether or not your equipment can do it. Take a look at tunnelbroker.net and through some of the help files. Again, there's a lot of templates they have canned out there that will show you how to build your gear to nail that tunnel up. Well, maybe this is kind of an obvious question, but why are you guys offering this service, A, at all, and then B, why are you offering it for free?
Well, we're offering it at all because somebody had to do it and we got there first. We're doing it for free for several reasons. We're a community-minded organization, and this has been a great opportunity to do something that doesn't really cost us all that much to provide, but provides great value to the community. We learned a lot about IPv6 in the early days when we were first setting this up from actually going through the exercise of doing it. And it's actually been a lot of fun for us, and it opens a lot of doors and creates a lot of opportunities. So we really are proud of it and happy with it, and we're glad that we're able to give back to the community in this way.
There's another thought here, which some folks are going, do I really have to worry about IPv6 at this point? Because carrier grade NAT, that's going to save us all. That's just, we can just keep pushing this IPv4 thing along even further, and IPv6 is really still years away. What do you think about that?
I think carrier grade NAT is more likely to kill us than save us. NAT in its current form is bad enough, and I'm very glad that I don't run NAT at home. But carrier-grade NAT is all the bad things about present-day NAT, plus a whole host of additional problems that I just don't want to think about. Every time I start thinking about, you know, bigger, more complicated forms of NAT, it just makes me shudder. And I think anybody touting the virtues of carrier-grade NAT has never thought it through seriously in a large end-user ISP scenario. It's ugly.
I mean, that in and of itself is a pain. Most of us have learned to deal with it, translating our private address space to public ones for the purpose of address conservation. But then if you try to scale that even bigger, so that the carrier's doing it, where there's yet a third layer of, or yeah, there's really, there's three layers of NAT going on there potentially. dealing with logs, dealing with identifying sources of issues. It'll make your head explode.
Yeah.
But we're used to it as well. I mean, the resistance to going to IPv6 for most people is, you know, I've got my IPv4, it's working, there's not much IPv6 out there. It's a bit of a death spiral, isn't it? You know, a dog trying to catch its own tail. But at some point, the IPv4 addresses will be exhausted and we will, something's going to have to break. And while some carriers are looking to delay investment in their backbones by just natting on natting on NAT, you know, they do NAT44 or NAT444, where they actually NAT three times. So you know, just explain what carrier-grade NAT is for people who haven't perhaps given it any thought, is that you might have a city, and they might use a 10/8 for the entire city. So there's enough IP addresses to, you know, give everybody a 10. But as the traffic aggregates at the edge, where the city then uplinks to the main backbone, they do a NAT there. In a firewall or an appliance or a router, whatever it might be. It's usually just an ordinary Cisco router or Juniper router. And then that traffic then runs up into a major POP. And as it comes into the major POP and leaves then to go into the major backbone, it then NATs again. And then it'll get rerouted to where the internet connectivity gateway is, and it'll go to the nearest destination according to the backbone structure around the geography of the region. So, for example, in the UK, your traffic might go from Manchester down to London, where it'll be NATed as it comes out of Manchester, then it'll get to London, and then it'll be NATed as it gets dispatched to the backbone. And let's say you're coming off the west coast of the UK because you're going out that pipe, then as you hit the dispatch, the internet pipe on the west coast, it'll get NATed into the IP address. So your connection goes NATed once in Manchester, NATed once in London, NATed into the public IP address as it leaves. And that's the current sort of carrier grade NAT. And you can imagine there's state in all of those. And of course, when you get to the other end, people are denatting. So translating from public IPs back to private IPs to hit services.
Yep. Right?
So your public IP address hits a VIP on a load balancer, which might terminate the session, or it might be, you know, NATed to attach to a mail server, or, you know, and all of this state has to be kept, because if when the packets come back into the NAT table, so if that router in Manchester reboots, all of those NAT translations are lost. They're not readily able to fail over. Most carriers don't care. If the router reboots, they'll just, you know, you just have to try again. Too bad you. Why bother building in state? We're just a carrier. We're not here to actually like our customers because we hate you, remember?
And there's even a more common problem that people are going to run into, which is when suddenly all of the UK starts looking like it comes out of a single address on the west coast of England, all these things that use geolocation to provide you localized information like Google Maps and Yelp and all of that are all going to think everybody in the UK lives in that one little town on the west coast of London, the west coast of England, rather.
It's actually worse than that, because a significant number of the ISPs here actually terminate in the Netherlands. So they actually
go. There you go.
And it's not uncommon for me to connect to certain corporate networks, especially. It's very more common. And for suddenly for Google to appear in Dutch or Flemish or, you know, something equally, or French. And that's because my packets are popping out and Google says, well, that IP belongs there. That is a challenge. That's a major challenge. It's going to get worse. But
yeah, I can just imagine how well all the Brits will react to, you know, suddenly having Google in frog.
I love our French cousins. They like us.
We're all illustrating a point here that IPv6 has got to be the way the world goes. We just can't prolong IPv4 forever. It's not an answer. It's a stopgap that we've been stopgapping for kind of a long time now already, and it's time to move on. So, I mean, if you're sitting out there and you're just scared to death of IPv6 because, my gosh, the address space is so long and there's letters in it now because it's hex, I don't want to do it. Go over to tunnelbroker.net and sign up and start getting used to it. Get a handle on this thing. It's not... Yes, it's different than IPv4, but not brain surgery exactly. And Owen, who's actually eligible to use the service? Does it have to be just a person, or can a corporation jump on this too?
No, actually, we've got a number of corporations that get IPv6 connectivity through our Tunnel Broker service. And if you're worried about the fact that it's not really a production grade service, it's a best effort free service, then you know, we're happy to take your money. We do have a production grade tunneling service that we sell to people, and they're welcome to contact me about that, and we'll get them set up with that if that's what they need.
Great. Another thing that I know network engineers that have started getting into IPv6 and studying it and trying to understand it, there's a lot of tunnels that are tunneling types that have been created to allow you to interact with an IPv4 service. And it can be a little overwhelming. Well, you use this one if you want to do this, and you use this other one if you want to do that. Well, what kind of a tunnel is it that you guys are using for tunnelbroker.net, and why did you pick that kind?
We're using 6in4. That's 6in4, 6in4. And we chose that because it's the simplest, cleanest, most straightforward tunneling protocol. The only real disadvantage to it versus any of the others is, well, two things. Number one, it has to be configured by hand. It doesn't configure itself automatically, which makes it far more reliable and easier to troubleshoot. So that's actually, in my opinion, a net win. And then the other disadvantage is it doesn't work all that well through NAT. In most cases, it doesn't work at all through NAT. So
you need a public IPv4 address talking to your public IPv4 address.
Ideally, yes. And the reality is, generally, if you're doing an IPv6 tunnel, you want to put it kind of out at your edge where you probably have a public IPv4 address at the moment anyway. So it's usually not too much of a problem that that's the case, because usually, you know, most people that are doing this in a house, for example, want to terminate the tunnel on their home gateway, where they do all the routing and NATing anyway. So, having it terminate on the public address of that gateway is no big deal.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's exactly what I did as well. My little home gateway serves up IPv6 addressing inside the house and then tunnels it out to Hurricane Electric right there at the edge, using that IPv4 public address I have as the transport.
Yep, and for people with more complicated topologies in their houses, it's not a problem. We've got a little checkbox you can check, and you can get a 48 if you need a 48, or by default, we give you a 64 for the point-to-point link from your on the tunnel, and then another 64 to use inside your house.
Now, are those routable? I mean, is that a real IPv6 address?
Yep, it's a real IPv6 address. We dole them out of our two prefixes that we got from Aaron. We started out with a 32. We used up most of that and went back under the new IPv6 policy that just got enacted a little while ago, and actually got a /24 to allow us to continue expanding.
Now, if you're thinking /24 in terms of IPv4 address space, that's not very much, but an IPv6 address space, that's huge.
Yeah, it's we think the /24 will suffice for quite some time.
Yeah, remember that whereas in IPv4 you're dealing with a 32-bit address space, with IPv6 you're dealing with 128 bits. So when you're talking about /24, meaning the first 24 bits of the address defining the supernet, the aggregate network, if you will, you're getting, how many addresses is that? It's quadrillions or something like that, right?
It's 16.7 million /48.
Yeah.
So that's enough for us to support 16.7 million end sites.
Yeah, end sites, including all the stuff that's in those end sites.
Exactly.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah, you compare that to the IPv4 address space. What's that? 4.2 million possible addresses.
4.2 billion.
4.2 billion possible addresses, and we're talking about, that's if everything was one address. You know, yep. One address was one subnet. So if everything was a /24, there'd be 4.2 million subnets out of IPv4. Let's pretend that the E class, you know, the restricted subnets actually exist.
Yeah.
So even if we gave everybody
16.7 million subnets.
Yes. So even if we gave everybody a 48, which is an awful lot of addresses, and a lot of people will actually get 64s in their houses and so forth, there's still 16.7 million endpoints or locks, you know.
Yeah, the address.
Yeah, I'm actually hoping that most people do get more than a 64 and do actually get a 48 in their household, because I think that the days of flat topologies in households are fairly numbered at this point.
So when somebody nails up a tunnel to Hurricane Electric, what are they hitting on your side? Are you at liberty to discuss the secret sauce back there?
No, we don't divulge the secret sauce, in terms of what's on our backside, but we do actually provide a very reliable service, and it's worked out pretty well. It's fairly automated, so it's not too hard to use and
easy to manage.
Yep,
because you're giving it away for free, so it would have to be automated. You'd have lots of scripting, lots of engines to be able to just take it, build it, work out what needs to be done.
Exactly. One other thing I'll mention is if you have your own portable addresses that you've gotten from a regional internet registry or some other source, we do also support BGP-based tunnels. So you can actually bring your own addresses to the party if you need to as well.
Huh, okay. So that brings us to talking about, so once the tunnel's up, what are you going to do with it? Once we've got IPv6 traffic flowing, I mean, where what can we hit today that's IPv6 enabled?
Well, there's lots of things you can hit that are IPv6 enabled today. Facebook, Google, YouTube. Somebody put up a dancing turtle somewhere once upon a time, I think.
Oh, good.
You can also work through the Hurricane Electric IPv6 certification program, which will help you learn about IPv6 and steps you through some basic IPv6 tasks, like setting up a web server, an email server, building up DNS records for IPv6. And when you complete that program and achieve the SAGE level, we'll even give you a spiffy IPv6 t-shirt.
Now, do you happen to know, Owen, what percentage of the internet is IPv6 ready? I know it's a small number these days.
I don't off the top of my head.
I want to say it's still single digits, though.
I think it's pretty rapidly approaching 10% if it's not over that.
Mm. Yeah, so there's more coming out there.
Yeah, and with the announcement of IPv6 launch day that came out yesterday, I think we're going to see even more momentum as we build towards June.
Yeah, there's a day on June 6th where as many of the bigger companies as possible are trying to launch IPv6 as a permanent part. So was it a year ago that we had the Facebook did IPv6 for a week or for a day? Google had IPv6 for a while. Cisco's website was IPv6 enabled for a while.
Uh-huh.
And the follow-up to that is to have one day where everybody actually turns on IPv6 permanently, and Facebook has announced, Yahoo's announced, Google's announced that they will have IPv6 from this day and permanently going forward it will be part of the profile. So some of the biggest web properties are coming to the party in a sort of a display of, you know, in a peacock display to say you should follow us type thing.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that they've chosen my birthday as the day to do this.
Let me guess, that's why you helped to set that day? Is that part of your work in there?
I actually wasn't involved in the decision on that day.
That is very cool, though, I must say.
I think they chose the day because it happened to be 6-6.
Yeah. Okay, right. So it'd be good on both sides of the world. European 6-6 is the same as it is in America.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we can't get the order wrong.
Europe, the days are the same. In Asia, they get 6-6 a day before we do.
Yeah, well, aside from the time zone thing. But, yeah, Ethan and I have that problem all the time because he's in America and I am in England.
I have actually changed the format on dates for documents that Greg and I share just to make sure the two of us don't get it confused. Well, Owen, let me ask you this, because I'm starting to think about what are the possibilities of this tunnel. I mean, you can nail up the tunnel, but then you could get kind of crazy with it. But potentially, I don't know what you guys allow. Can you do something crazy like advertise? Well, I guess you said this. You can advertise your own address space you've got through this tunnel. So that would include actually nailing up an IPv6 BGP session through the tunnel?
Absolutely. In fact, if you look up who is on 2620:0:930, which is a /48, and check its routing, you'll see that it's routed out through Hurricane's tunnel broker and through layer 42. It's multi-homed, and that's the actual prefix sitting in my house. That's my 48 that I got from Aaron for my household, and it's routed native through the tunnel. So I know we support it because it's working for me. It's how we're talking right now.
Now, you said multi-homed, meaning you can use the tunnelbroker.net service as like a redundant IPv6 connection.
Well, you could get redundant connections to two different tunnel brokers, but in my case, I'm actually connected to Hurricane Electric and to another ISP through another tunnel.
So there's really a lot of flexibility here. It's more than just a toy service. Commercial grade in that, yes, we can go to Hurricane Electric and pay for more serious connectivity, if you will, but this is highly functional.
Oh, yeah, it's very functional.
All right. Now, okay, in my case, every once in a while my IPv4 address is going to change because my ISP just likes to change my IP from time to time. What happens to my tunnel at that point?
You've got Comcast too, huh?
It's actually Metrocast, a smaller regional over here in the East Coast and Northeast up in the U.S., but yeah, they do. Yeah, they change
basically
it.
Basically, you get on Tunnel Broker you know, you get on the website and you you update the address in your tunnel configuration, and you're back in business. You might have to update your CPE config as well if that's necessary, but it's pretty straightforward. And in fact, I actually have not only the cable ISP, but I have a DSL provider, which is very, very slow compared to the cable that I've got, but it has the advantage that it has a fixed address. So when my cable address gets renumbered, I SSH in through the DSL connection, which also has BGP tunnels on it, and I update the config to put the cable tunnel back in place, and everything starts working again.
Cool. But the case being, though, I mean, if we remember that this is a 6-4 tunnel, it does not do dynamic address assignment. If your dynamic address happens to change, all you got to do is go into tunnelbroker.net, update the new IPv4 endpoint of your side of the tunnel. Tunnel comes back up and everything's good again.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, now I've got this tunnel nailed up, and I've got, let's say, a web server that I've got listening on my IPv6 address. Mm-hmm. What do I do with DNS to make that work?
You put a quad A record in your DNS zone and you're done.
Aha. So my IPv4 DNS server can handle my quad A IPv6 address record, you're saying?
Sure, absolutely. But why wouldn't you also put it up on V6 as well?
Well, that would be, you know, the next question then is, you know, DNS servers that I could take advantage of that are native IPv6 DNS servers. Is that something that you guys are doing?
Yeah, we've got a free DNS service that we provide that people are more than welcome to use, and it's dual stat. Most of the commercial DNS providers out there are supporting V6 on their name servers now. So that's pretty easy to do. There's lots of DNS services out there that are V6, and frankly, it's just not that hard to run bind, which is what I do.
No, actually, it is. It's beyond most people.
I was just going to say, it all depends. I mean, no, it's not, but yes, it is.
It's not hard. Anybody that can configure BGP can run bind.
Yeah, but it's really easy to configure bind the first time. It's really hard to keep it going every day of the week, and, you know, 365 days a year.
Really? I haven't found it to be that hard.
That implies that I've got a machine that I can run bind on for a start.
Well, I figure the same machine I'm running Apache on runs bind pretty well, so...
Yeah. I don't have anything in my house that runs Apache.
I think you made a fair statement when if someone can sort out BGP, someone can sort out bind and, you know, in DNS. And certainly there's other DNS resources that are out there. For me, it's more an issue of, I don't really feel like running a DNS server at my house. I used to run web servers and mail servers and all the rest of it at my house. Exactly. I'd rather take advantage of a service that's out there, like OpenDNS, to do that
for
me.
There's lots of options out there for DNS service providers, but we started the DNS conversation based on I've got my web server at home, so I figured, you know, you might as well throw a DNS server on that anyway.
Fair enough. And the really point that I wanted to make is quad A records are your answer. If you're thinking, well, my DNS server doesn't take IPv6 addresses, what do I do about that? It's because you're trying to do an A record and you want to do a quad A record that will allow you to build, put an IPv6 address in there and have that be responded to.
Yeah, exactly. The addresses are four times as long, so you need four times as many A's in the record type.
Yeah, it's a good way to remember it.
That's how they did it.
Now, Owen, one of the things I liked about tunnelbroker.net is it is really tailored to someone who is trying to get a handle on IPv6 and learn it. So are there other resources that you'd recommend out there for people that are trying to get smart about IPv6?
No, I think our tunnelbroker.net certification process is one of the best things out there. Beyond that, I think experience really is one of the best teachers. There's also some forums at tunnelbroker.net that provide a good opportunity for interactive learning and sharing experiences, tips, techniques, etc.
So I wanted to ask you some quick questions about businesses who want to multi-home their IPv6 networks.
Sure.
So like today, we would multi-home one IP range and then have two connections away. I'm flapping my hands here at the virtual whiteboard, you know, big virtual hand drawing diagrams. So just imagine those, right? And so we would, and then as we reach our IPv4 addresses internally, would then NAT into that. So regardless of which provider we're connecting to, the internet still sees us as one contiguous address space, correct?
Well, that's certainly one way you can do it. It's not the way that most of my clients have preferred to do their IPv4 multi-homing. And what I've set up for most of my clients is we get them actual internet registry, RIR-issued public address ranges for their public addresses, and then we multi-home those using BGP. And you know, it can be a pretty simple, straightforward BGP config where you take default from two providers and advertise your single prefix to each of those two providers, and you're done. But that allows you to multi-home in a reliable and redundant way using a single address space with both providers. And you can do that exact same thing on IPv6, no problem.
Yeah. So you're saying you would, you know, let's say you want to have redundant internet connections, you'd have each link with a V6 prefix that you would get from that provider?
You might number the links out of the prefix from that provider, but I would actually, if you're multi-homing, go ahead and go to the RIR and get a /48 or whatever larger block you need and announce that over the BGP to the two providers.
So most of the providers I'm talking to are refusing to do that today because they don't want to load IPv6 prefixes into their routers, because they're saying that if everybody started to multi-home, they would have the IPv6 routing table would actually blow out. They don't want customers to own their own IPv6 prefixes because they would actually have to upgrade their routers.
Yeah, wah. providers, you know,
yeah, okay.
do your IPv6 with a tunnel to Hurricane. I don't know.
Okay, so let's just take that. So one of the other things that's been talked about is this concept of a prefix translation, where internally to your network you use your own. So you, let's say you have a /48.
Yeah,
so,
it's not quite as ugly as NAT, but it still, you know, has most of the evils of NAT.
Well, yeah, I'm sort of... Yeah, I'm a bit on the fence about prefix translation. I can see how it's goes back to the original purpose where, you know, let's say you have a /48 internally to in your network and you have lots of addresses all around, you know, whatever, subnets distributed. And then when your packet gets to the edge router, it just changes the first 48 bits from some internal prefix to some allocated prefix from the carrier. And carriers are currently looking to force that onto customers. Now, frankly, customers should say no, you must upgrade your equipment because that's good for customers, by the way.
You know,
your carriers, a lot of your carriers are running on 30-year-old equipment because customers haven't forced them to upgrade. And so you should say, no, I want a native prefix. Go to your RIR and get a prefix. But if your carrier says, we want you to use true prefix translation, what they're saying is, you know, you get a /48. We'll give you a /48 prefix that you can have, which is in our allocation, and then when the packets, you can have your own IPv6 internally, but when you send the packets out to us, we're going to change the first 48 bits from your prefix to my prefix for that carrier so that it'll come back that way. And they'll try and sell that to you as an advantage because it will, the traffic will go out and come back that way. It won't get diversely routed. It'll go via a guaranteed path. Do you think
the problem with that is it won't get diversely routed, so You have no redundancy, and also, or at least no session mobility type redundancy, and also you have the disadvantage that unless there's application layer gateways, you break things like SIP.
Yeah, that's true.
So I view it as having most of the disadvantages of NAT, but not all of them.
Yeah, because you don't have to have stateful. All it's doing is stripping the prefix and rewriting it, so it's not actually breaking into the payload, theoretically.
Right, so you don't get the stateful inspection firewall that you do get from NAT as sort of an add-on bonus, but you get most of the disadvantages still anyway.
Well, it's not a bonus to have firewall NAT. It's fixing the problem. You know, it's a nasty cruft that sits on the back of a firewall. It doesn't add security. It just solves the challenge of not upgrading to IPv6 10 years.
Oh, we're on the same page. I agree.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to see if that was sort of, you know, an interesting one, whether you thought that was going to get off the ground or whether that's just going to be something that'll...
I suspect it will unfortunately get off the ground. I think overall it's bad for customers.
So customers should avoid it at this time, because I think most applications will break with prefix translation and they should stay away from it.
Yep. I think that's true.
So for the time being, prefix translation may come, but for now you should avoid it like the plague and do your own native IPv6, would be the advice we would give to listeners.
That would be my advice, yes.
Sure. I would broadly agree with that. Well, I'll have to start working on my tunnel, won't I, Ethan?
Yes, I'm so depressed hearing you conclude the conversation that way, because one of the exciting things to me about IPv6 is the opportunity to have it native end-to-end and none of this NAT anymore, for all of the advantages that it brings. And every time I turn around, there's some other NAT solution for all the wrong reasons, the wrong thing to do for the wrong reasons, generally speaking. I mean, there's exceptions always, but... And it's a little frustrating. So I'm hopeful that we're going to get by this, and customers are going to demand IPv6 natively to be allowed end to end, and life's going to be good when we get there, I think.
Yeah, the one that scares me about this NAT stuff even more than the prefix translation idea that a lot of ISPs are pushing as the multi-homing solution for V6 is the number of enterprise IT people that don't seem to be able to comprehend that NAT is not a security measure, and they're just saying, you know, well, the only way we're going to implement IPv6 is if we can NAT it the way we do IPv4, and, you know, have our address obfuscation and our layered security that we get from NAT, where people can't see our addresses outside and all of this. And it's just, you know...
We've argued that point on the show before, that NAT is truly not security, and gotten pushback from some listeners on that, who really feel that it is, for what you're saying. Obfuscation somehow is security in their mind.
Yeah, and in fact, it's actually antithetical to security, because it makes it harder to identify and track down attackers.
That's right. It's like saying having a P.O. box gives you some level of security for your mail. So instead of sending the mail directly to your house, where your house address is, you send it to a P.O. box. But that just means you look up my name and you'll find my house address in the yellow pages. Yo-ho! You know, it's very difficult to hide your physical address away from the internet these days, and pretending that a P.O. box is going to somehow hide your home address from anybody is just laughable these days. and that is what NAT is. That's the analogy, the metaphor I'm currently using.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with it.
Well, it was a pretty good conversation that we had. Owen, thank you very much for coming on. You were a fantastic guest, sir. Now, by any chance, do you tweet or blog? Is there some way that folks can follow you out there on the internet?
I do occasionally blog on www.theipv6experts.net. I don't blog very often. I probably should write something new for that site. I haven't done that in a while. I don't tweet. You know, there's just only so many things a man can tolerate in terms of all of these day-to-day intrusions into one's general existence. And so tweeting is one that I have resisted thus far. But you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Facebook. And that's about as far as I go.
That's great. Well, again, thanks for coming on the show. And we got to have you back sometime. That would be...
Sounds good.
That would be a lot of fun here. For sure. Great. Thank you. And... Mr. Farrow, what's the week hold for you, sir? And of course, how can folks follow you on the internet?
Yes, well, this week is all about Cisco Security Manager and Firewall Service Modules for me.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's grim. It's grim. It's all Java.
And better you than me.
As I trawl through a firewall rule base and fix up some problems. But it's not bad. It's a nice break from doing some of the more dreamy stuff. I like being back on the tools, which has been great. People can, of course, find me on my blog at etherealmind.com or on the Twitter as @etherealmind. I also hang out on Google+. I'd like to do more there, so if you have the time to follow me there and, you know, drop me a line and I'll send something suitably witty and pithy back just as soon as I find out what witty and pithy means.
Hey, while you're redoing all those rule sets, don't forget to add the IPv6 capabilities to them, too.
AFWSMs don't do IPv6.
Oh!
Well, everybody, it's been a good show. Thank you for listening to the show this week. You can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter @PacketPushers. Visit PacketPushers.net to read blogs by the growing Packet Pushers community. Subscribe to our RSS feeds and donate to the show if you'd like. Email your comments or questions about this show to PacketPushers@gmail.com. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.
I think, well, that's why we have the show. We want to try and keep it as technically, you know, upright as possible, because I don't think there's enough.
The best thing about being a nerd is chicks dig it.